Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep it an open mind, you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. And you will also come to see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, it's my honor and privilege to have a colleague, author colleague by the name of Shane Bryant, who is also a movie star in his own right. Shane was born in London. He studied law at Trinity College Dublin and passed out top of the law school. His first professional role as Hamlet was while he was still in his teens. He was nominated in 1973 by the London Theatre Critics for the Most Promising Newcomer for his performance in a three-hander called Children of the Wolf at the Apollo Theatre in the West End of London. Shane has starred in 34 films in the U.S., the U.K., Europe, and Australia, 14 television plays and miniseries for the BBC and ITV, and in the USA has starred in 3 primetime networked telemovies. He is a best-selling author of The Weber Agenda, The Chastened Catalyst, Hit Kids, Bite of the Lotus, Graphic. And his most recent novels have been Worst Nightmares, and the sequel is The Dreamcatchers. You can find all of those at Amazon.com. Now, here's what Shane has to say about religion. I was brought up a non-practicing Anglican. My very troubled childhood militated against my believing there was any God out there looking out for me. This colored my religious judgment as a child and has remained with me ever since. For while I would love to believe there is one God who loves mankind, I see such universal suffering around the world affecting more than 90% of humankind. So where is the hand of God? And how can there be different gods? Those that look after Christians only, and those that look after Muslims and all the other religions. I have never liked dogma, religious works such as the Bible and the Quran, and those that dress in fancy clothes and call themselves priests, bishops, and those chosen by their specific gods. I believe in the spirituality of goodness, kindness, and love. The present Pope Francis espouses such beliefs, and I would gladly follow his beliefs. And so with that said, in Shane's own words, let me welcome Shane tonight. How are you doing, Shane?
Very well, thank you, David. Thank you for saying all those nice things about me.
Well, the words were put into my mouth by you, and thank you. Thank you for your brilliant career and that very moving personal statement that you had. And I'd like to start there talking a little bit about that, because one of the premises of my show is to open people's minds to the gateways of understanding around spirituality, which we all are spiritual beings, I maintain. However, for whatever reason, many of us have been turned off to even the notion of spirituality, and certainly religion has been a big button for many people, and people have actually suffered from religious abuse in terms of the beliefs that have been foisted upon them. For instance, the idea that if they don't accept Jesus Christ into their hearts as Lord and Savior, that they'll be cast into the eternal fires of hell. So, anyhow, you talked about a troubled childhood and that made it difficult for you to believe that there was a God out there that was watching over you. Is there anything that you'd like to tell us about that and how that has shaped yourself and the challenges that you found along the way as you came into a period of prolonged success within your life?
Well, I mean, my childhood was, it wasn't, I mean, I was never an abused child, but I came from a broken home, and there were a lot of problems with my family, and I was semi-adopted by another family, and I never really felt I fitted in with that family. But the most important thing was that I really didn't feel, you know, although I was being told all the time that, you know, I was a Christian boy and that the Lord Jesus loved me, I didn't feel that he was doing enough to look after me. You know, he didn't really love me because he wasn't doing anything to help me, and he certainly wasn't doing anything to help my mother, who was in a very bad state, and my brother, who was, you know, who was in a very bad state and you know, didn't know what to do and was thinking of turning to crime. And, you know, so where was God looking out for us, you know? And as the years passed, more and more people were saying, you know, well, you shouldn't be a Christian, you know, you should be a Muslim, because then our God will look after you and he'll be good to you. But I didn't see that Muhammad and the Muslim religion were looking after the Muslims any better than Jesus was looking after us.
Uh-huh.
And every time you looked at the television, you'd see millions of people suffering, and no, there wasn't a God out there who was doing anything to help them. And yet, every time you went onto Facebook, there was someone saying, you know, you should be so happy because Jesus is looking after you.
Mm.
Well, I didn't see any evidence of that.
Well, I can relate to that. Now, I came from a traumatic childhood, but I disassociated from my trauma and didn't come to understand it or even recognize it until I was an adult. So I was able to go along with the concepts of Christianity as I was raised, and I believed that Jesus was watching out over me and must have protected me so that I did not have to experience the trauma at those points in time when it happened. But I don't mean to get into my story. I'm just trying to relate to something that I want to come to, and that is that when I came to understand some of these things for myself, I too took the position of where was the God in that. And of course, I became very cynical as I'd studied history over the years and looked at all the people that were persecuted and killed in the name of this, that, or the other thing, especially Christians that were killing others during the Crusades and the Inquisition and the like. And I came to believe that religion did more harm than good. But I have come to see, in retrospect, that there's been a dark lining to there's been a silver lining to every dark cloud, in that I was brought through some of the darkest hours of my life and have come to embrace who I am today and have a successful and prosperous life today and am beholden to a power greater than myself because I was in the depths. And if it were not for some glimmer of hope that I couldn't even see at that time, I wouldn't be here today. And so I've become a very spiritual person. I don't really believe in religion unless it serves the soul. But I see you as a very spiritual man in the way you lead your life. And just the fact that you have been brought from a place that was not so good for you growing up to a place where I presume you found happiness for yourself. Would you like to comment about any of that?
Yeah, I thought you put things so well that I kept on, you know, what you said about the Inquisitions and Christians and what they'd done in terms of history, how they'd killed so many people. even as a 10-year-old child, you know, it seemed illogical for me to believe that killing anyone in the name of a religion was something that God would espouse, be it any particular God, you know, the Christian God, the Hindu God, the Muslim God, you know, that so many terrible things were done in the name of religion and still are done in the name of religion. And I well remember my mother, who was a complete atheist, she said, if there's a God, I'm going to come back and I'm going to say, and I'll come back and have a chat with you. And the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to give you all the numbers of the lottery, because I think it's only fair. From the other side, I'll be able to know what these are, and I've been doing them for 25 years. And I've never won. And I just want you to win a few million dollars. So, and I haven't had a word or peep out of her. But I did think to myself, well, that's not what God does. God doesn't allow people to come back from the other side. A lot of people have said to me, you've said to me that you had near-death experiences and you've seen experienced people from the other side, and a lot of people have had the same sort of experiences. I know my wife, her mother was one time, she was as a young child, she was sitting outside on a bench. And she was a child at the time, and suddenly her father, who had just died, was sitting next to her, and he said, "You're going to be all right. You'll be fine without me."
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I was when Wendy said that to me, you know, I kind of thought, "Yeah."
Uh-huh.
I've heard these stories before, but when you hear them from someone that you is not prone to telling fibs and is quite a sincere person, you tend to think, well, I don't know, I just wish that someone had come back from the other side and have a chat with me.
Well, you know what, Shane, this is a personal aside, and also to anybody else that's listening tonight, one of the guests that I have on my show is a brilliant psychic medium from Australia by the name of Kat Edwards. She could put you in touch with your mother or other people that might want to speak to you, and I can give you information about that at a later point in time. But Kat [S2] Right. [S1] Is one of a number of spiritually gifted people that I have on my show. Another one is Leo Bonomo, who is from the UK, and they are marvelous psychic mediums. And I think unless you've had one of those profound experiences, there's absolutely no way you could relate to them or even believe them to be true.
Yeah, that's true. That's true until it happens. But I remember my godmother, who was a wonderful woman called Mary Stopes, and she was the pioneer in England. She was the first person to pioneer birth control. And she was a doctor of medicine, and she was a really very great historical figure. And she was actually my brother's godmother. But she told me one day, she lived in a huge house in the countryside of England. She told me once that we went there for weekends, and she said, last week a spaceship came down and landed in the garden outside the house. They invited me on board, and I went up and I spent the whole day. We swooped off and went off somewhere, and I spent the whole day with the space people in their spaceship, and then they dropped me off back home. Now, as a child, what are you supposed to think?
Right.
Are you supposed to think they're completely bonkers, off their head, or are you supposed to think, oh, wow, that's amazing. You know, nobody saw it. There were, in a position of power realized there was a spaceship hovering in the middle of the English countryside, and that this wonderful intelligent woman is gone completely off her rocker, or are you supposed to think, that's interesting, wow, that's amazing, I wish I'd been there. It's you know, it just makes you think about things.
It certainly does, and that's been one area that's been hard for me to swallow. However, as I've had guests on the show who've had such encounters that are strong believers, I've had to come to rethink my thinking about that, and I have people that read from the Book of Lives, the Akashic Records, and they sometimes read of lives that were held in other planetary systems. And so, you know, it's all cause for wonder, certainly. And I try not to judge anything anymore. I believe that everything happens for a reason and all in its good time, and that whatever needs to be revealed to me or to anyone will be revealed in time, you know. And so I just accept that, and I have to take everything with a few grains of salt, but I try to keep an open mind.
I think, you know, you're wonderful because you can, as you say, you have such an open mind, and I find it difficult not to become cynical about things when I see what's happening this week around the world, and all those refugees with nowhere to go, and where's the hand of God? And yet, at the same time, you see that, you know, the goodness of the people of Germany taking in people and giving them food and lodging and
yes,
and whatever. And you see the other side of it, too. So,
well, I think it's important to always see the good in every seemingly bad situation. And that's the reason, of course, I never believed in reincarnation. I was not taught that belief as a child, but I've come to embrace it as true. And it happened to me suddenly when I had an out-of-body experience 35 years ago. But to me, spiritually, it makes sense that for somebody to have a lifetime of abject misery is not fair. While somebody else can have a life where they're born with a silver spoon in their mouth and have no real problems. I mean, not to say that everybody doesn't have their own problems, but some are so much greater than the others. It's the only thing that makes spiritual sense to me. And I came to be a believer not because of that, but because of what was told to me when I had an out-of-body experience. And more people are coming to believe in reincarnation, and even Jesus taught it, but it was struck down from his teachings that the early Christians, the Gnostics, believed and practiced by the Council of Nicaea, which also picked and chose the Gospels that would be in the Bible, therefore controlling people through fear of damnation, that if they didn't get it right in this life, that they'd burn forever in hell.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know.
Well, but does that mean that if you have a really nice life, and you have a successful career, and you have a happy marriage and two beautiful children, that you're going to come back as a scorpion?
No, no way. And it doesn't work that way anyhow. You only come back a human. The only thing is that you accumulate karma. And if there are things that you've done that could be perceived as bad, if you will, I mean, nothing is bad in God's eyes. There's no right or wrong. There's no good or bad. It all just is in the spiritual kingdom. But if you accumulate some karma that is dysfunctional, then you need to come back to iron it out. And you're always given a chance to get it right. And supposedly, when you've achieved that, then you don't have to come back anymore. And, so if you lead a good life and make your amends in this life, there's no reason to come back unless you choose to come back to have another human experience.
Well, that's nice. That's nice because I believe in karma. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be nice if you came back and had to make amends for the things that you did wrong. That makes sense, and I'd love to do that.
Well, why don't we move on and talk about things that you'd like to talk about? I'm certain you'd like to talk about your books, and then I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your professional history, because I think that would be interesting
All right.
for our listeners. So why don't you start off where you'd like to go, and then I will ask you some questions.
Well, it all started in 1996. My father was an author, years and years and years back, and he was editor of the Oxford University ISIS. And so I always kind of wanted to write. And in 1996, I was doing a television series which would take me to six European countries, a month in each country. And I thought, well, why don't you try writing a thriller, and you can do all the research as you go through all these different countries and actually walk the streets, see the places, describe where you're going, and make it really real so that the research really rings true. And I did that, and 6 months later I came back having written three pages each night. And naturally I had a whole book as a manuscript. So having edited it when I got back, I sent it to HarperCollins, the publishers, and it was immediately sent back. So this is something I suggest, that people always get an agent, because if you don't have an agent and you send it to a recognized publisher, they will always send it back because they think you're no good.
That's right.
I asked a friend of mine who happened to be a literary agent. I said, would you represent me? And he read the book and he said, yeah, sure. I'll offer it to HarperCollins. And I said, well, actually, I've sent it to them and they sent it back. And he said, well, yeah, but I don't suppose they actually read it.
Right.
So what I'll do is I will send it. And I know somebody there, the publisher myself. So he sent it to the publisher, and the publisher got back within 2 days and said, I love it. It's fantastic. I love it. We'll publish. So that made me laugh. And so that was published, and then another one was published, the sequel. And then I wrote one, and this is another bit of advice. I wrote one which was a little bit politically incorrect insofar as HarperCollins didn't like it, because it concerned, the subject matter was about a hitman who has a very clever son, and the son takes over the business when his father is killed in a traffic accident. And the son is only 10 years old and becomes a gun for hire. And HarperCollins said, look, this isn't suitable as a novel. We don't have children killing people. And I said, but children do kill people. All over, you know, it happens all the time. Anyway, they wouldn't publish, so I published myself, and then I self-published for a long time, and that it's personally gratifying. Of course, you don't earn any money doing it, because very few people read your books. It's expensive to publicize them.
Right.
And then eventually, I wanted to crack the American market, so I went to New York to see if I could get an agent there, and I was signed up by Curtis Brown in New York, and I was so happy, and I wrote another novel, and they loved it. That was called Worst Nightmares, and it was published in America, and I thought, well, I've made it here now. This is fantastic. If you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. But unfortunately, the company went broke. The Vanguard Press went bankrupt within a year, and I was left without a publisher again. But I'm still publishing. I still publish on Amazon, and I've got a new book out called Live Feed, and anyone that wants to read my books, they can just look me up on Amazon and read the books. Sometimes, you know, on Kindle, you know, only costs $2.50, so it's very good value.
Yes, it
and
is.
And what I try and do with my books is to not write just a vacuous thriller, but try and put in some of my thoughts about the way, you know, my belief systems, my ethics, and what I think is wrong about the world, and you know, what should be changed, and you know, just my views on life, not in a sort of way that people realize that I'm actually espousing a cause, but just so they see it without even noticing.
Well, there's a bit of all of us in our books. I mean, we write from our own experience, be it using people in our lives as characters, if you will, or be it expressing some of our life philosophies. That's very normal. And I have not read any of your books yet, but I'm very interested in doing so. Would you tell us about your most recent book, what that's about?
The latest book is called Live Feed, and the reason I wrote that was because I was getting increasingly angst-ridden about the way that the media handles the terrible events that happen every day in the world, you know, and the way they manipulate people who are watching TV in order to garner ratings, you know, so that, for instance, when there's a massacre in some school, they know that if they get the news crew out there and they've got interviews with distraught family members, and even better if they've got a picture of a dead child or a dead mother or blood spatter and all of that, people are going to tune in because there's something about human nature that people, they want to see it up close and personal. They want to see it in real time. They want to actually, you know, I'm not saying it started then, but at 9/11, people were glued to that television because they actually wanted to see the building come down and they wanted to see people leap out of buildings. And but nowadays, the television companies, they say, we would warn you that there are certain images which you will shortly see, which are very distressing. And they're not doing that because they're afraid that you will be distressed. They're saying it so that you will actually make sure you're watching, because people are, a lot of people are ghouls, and they want to watch these things. And so this book is about a company in New York, a television company, and they know that that their records, their ratings depend on getting information and real-life footage of terrible things that are going on in the world. And the more of that they can get, the better. And so it's couched in a story of five bank robbers that rob a bank and go to ground in a cave, and without their knowledge, this company lowers down a microphone and a video camera and starts taking live footage of the last 15 hours of their lives before the police come in and kill them all. You know, and all over the world, people are watching this live footage of these people trapped in a cave. And they're loving it, unfortunately. And I just think that so many people really do. They love to see, you know, if they can tune in and watch, look at, you know, a plane crash, and they say, you know, this is the moment it happened. And you see the plane coming in, you see it explode, and you know that 150 people are dead in that second. That you know that that will be a rating spike for that particular channel. And it's disgusting. It's disgraceful.
It is disgusting. And, you know, it points up the dark side of human nature, which has been around probably since time immemorial. I mean, look at back at the days of the Roman Colosseum and the people who would come there to see Christians thrown to the lions and all sorts of atrocities perpetrated against human beings. And we're
absolutely
still doing
right.
It today,
yeah.
You know, and through through the window to the world that television affords us, I mean, we can see all kinds of horrific things, beheadings, you name it. I mean, we don't even need to bend to them, but it's awful. What do you think it is about the dark side of human nature that they're so fascinated in such things?
Well, I think it's kind of a bit allied to horror movies and thrillers and watching thriller movies, and that is because the average person is sitting at home and he's safe, and he knows he's safe, but everyone else outside is not safe. So he enjoys watching people go through the most terrible things because he knows that it's not happening to him. So that he's okay. He doesn't have to worry about himself. And it's a kind of frisson that they get watching. I still don't know. It's as you say. It's a dark side of human nature that people like to see terrible things happen to other people, and even worse, that some human beings actually enjoy seeing, you know, killing people and watching the life disappear from their eyes, you know, and chopping their heads off. You know, they actually get a pleasure out of it. It's a part of twisted sort of sexual deviancy.
Well, it certainly is a total disconnect from humanity or from spiritual practices. I mean, my God, I don't understand, and I do understand why, based on that kind of thing, that there's not world peace today. People are fascinated with atrocity, and people go into their ego states and get into arguments with other people, and then there's no peace. And I'm just curious, do you think that we'll ever see world peace on this planet?
I find it very hard to believe we ever will, unless people are prepared to allow other people to believe in their own religions and live with their own religions. So, you know, that they won't say our God is better than your God.
Right.
Because since the world began, perhaps not cavemen, but since people started to think about things, they've always said, you know, I believe, and that's what I believe in, and you're wrong, I'm right. And there won't be, and also it's part of the human psyche and mindset that that young men love to fight, and they'll find something to fight about, you know, freedom, their freedom, religion, their homeland, their right to be Russians, their right to be Ukrainians, their right to be Serbians. And because they're Serb, you know, they will kill all the Muslims. Because they're a Muslim, they'll kill all the Serbs. So it just goes on and on and on. And until you're living in a society where people are happy, like, for instance, may I suggest Denmark or Norway or a lot of Scandinavia, there's free university, there's free health care. Everything seems to be free. It's one of the happiest countries in the world. Taxes are higher, but you get more for your money, you know, and they're much happier there. It's a bit cold, but I wouldn't mind living in Denmark.
I wouldn't either. I wouldn't either, you know, and it's wonderful that there are examples of humanity, if you will, out there, or people that are open-minded, that are free thinkers, that and I imagine there's very little crime in those countries too. I heard it said by a gentleman by the name of Carlo Ami, who is a prophet in his own time, if you will. He's been on my show, and he maintains that if you get 7,000 souls, humans, vibrating at the same level of consciousness, that it can bring world peace. Well, I don't know about that, but he cited an example of how there were a bunch of people meditating in this one city for a period of time. Maybe it was an hour, I don't remember, but the crime actually went down during that time period. And it's been said by various people, including Esther Hicks, who channels Abraham, that we live in a vibrational universe, and what we put out is what we get in return. And that goes back to karma. What goes around comes around. I believe in the power of positive thinking. What do you believe about that?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. If the whole world would meditate for 1 hour every day, or could do so, I mean, just imagine how much more relaxed everyone would be, and how much better the world would be. That's my thought, anyway. You know, just stop thinking negative thoughts and just try and relax and be happy, just for an hour. You know, despite everything.
Well, if we could find peace within ourselves, perhaps we'd find peace in the planet.
Yeah. Well, as my wife Wendy was saying yesterday, she said that they tried an experiment, and I can't remember. I think it was somewhere in Scandinavia. What they did was they decided that as an experiment they would make drug use legal. And see what happened. And all the money that they saved through arresting people, putting them in prisons, which was a vast amount of money, they spent all the money that was associated with criminalization, they put into rehabilitation of the offenders.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that the incidence of illegal meth use came down by almost 50%.
Wow. Well, you know, I've changed my thinking about drug use, and I'm a proponent of legalizing drugs. I think it would eliminate a lot of crime, not to mention some of these other benefits that you've talked about. You know.
Yeah, I just think I hate seeing people driving Lamborghinis. They're about 22 years old, and you know that you know where that money came from.
Sure.
And then, because we live close to an area in Sydney where there's quite a high incidence of drug taking, and you see these zombies walking around the street, and you know that the people in the Lamborghinis are making money out of the zombies in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was legal, and the, you know, because most of the drugs don't cost very much to actually make. They just cost a lot to buy, because they're being sold by people who are taking a risk of going to prison. So if it was legal, there would be no pushes.
Right.
Anyway, it's a very far out thought, but it's worth thinking about.
It certainly is, and I have no problem with far out talk, but let's move back in time to when you were in school. Now, you actually studied law, and what changed your pathway in life to go into theater?
Well, I was, my mother was, she was, just before the war, she was an actress, and she did plays in the West End with people like Rex Harrison, you know, who...
Oh, yes.
And Roland Calvert. And she was very, very pretty and gorgeous, and it was such a shame that her marriage broke down, because she was such a... She looked a bit like Grace Kelly. Very attractive, and so there was always that part of, in maybe in my gene pool, that I wanted to be an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to Trinity, I immediately joined the Trinity Players, which was like the Oxford Footlights, and it was the Amateur Dramatic Society, and I really enjoyed that. And then I turned professional, but I kept on doing law until the last year, when I passed out, I was given the opportunity of either going back to London and doing my barrister's exams and becoming a barrister and standing up in front of a court of law and defending people, or I was given the opportunity of being in this play, the one you mentioned, Children of the Wolf. And so I did that and then considered what my options were. And having done that, I was offered a 2-year contract to be in 4 movies. And when you're 22 and you're given an opportunity to star in four movies at Elstree Studios, or go back and do another 3 years studying, you know, what would you do? So
I'd do the thing you did.
I chose the glamorous option, and
sure.
I did the movies.
Sure.
And it could have been a big mistake, because I could have disappeared, and I think the statistics are that by the time you get to 60, about 85-90% of actors are no longer acting. They've done something else. They've given up. They haven't succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
But I was one of the lucky ones, and I've never had to do anything except act. Never been that rich, but I've never had to, you know, wait tables and do any of that stuff.
What are your best-known film roles? And which ones did what are your best-known film roles, and which ones did you like the best?
I think the ones that I liked the best were one of the first ones I did, which was The Picture of Dorian Gray, which I did in America.
Yes, I've seen that.
And I remember when we were filming that, the man, the actor who was in one of the original ones, who was Herd Hatfield, he visited the set for a bit of publicity. And the way he looked at me, I remember thinking, oh, my God, the man hates me because I look young. And he is now close to 60, and he hates me for being young and because he's old. And one day I'll be old, and I'll be like him. You know, I remember thinking that very vividly. And he shook my hand, and he looked at me, and he thought, oh, it was horrible. He wasn't happy that I was happy. Anyway, that was one of them, one of the roles, and Lady Chatterley's Lover was another of my favorites. And
yes, I've seen that too. Yeah.
And the Naked Civil Servant with about Quentin Crisp with John Hurt. I don't know if you've heard that was.
He's marvelous. I've seen The Naked Civil Servant, and I've read the book too. Yeah.
He was a wonderful guy and a most enchanting personality. And some of the roles I used to do at the BBC, I look back now and I think some of those plays of the month we used to do at the BBC were just, the quality was, and the writing was fantastic. There was, for instance, there was one which was called Notorious Woman, Rosemary Harris played George Sand, and Jeremy Irons played Franz Liszt, and George Sikiris played Franz Chopin, and it just was beautifully written, and it was, you know, and they were wonderful plays. And in those days, they were, you know, we'd do one a month. It would be Danton's Death, Notorious Woman, and the various wonderful plays. And since I've been in Australia, I've been doing mostly films, and mostly kind of thrillers. But I haven't been doing the quality of the films. The writing hasn't been what I was used to.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say that because I love Australia dearly, you know, there is quality. I just haven't been lucky enough to snare the roles.
Well,
you know,
time will tell the story. You never know what's around the corner.
It's not too late.
Yes.
Absolutely. You're dead right.
Now, you have worked with some real luminaries in stage and film. What has that been like for you, and how has that helped you develop your craft?
I remember doing a television series, Movie of the Week, in England, and it had a beautiful cast. There was Bill Bixby, you remember the green, Incredible Hulk, and and Helen Hayes.
Oh my God, yes.
And there was and Olivia de Havilland was playing the person who actually did it. It was a a whodunit with Agatha Christie type, you know. And I remember I was playing a scene with Olivia de Havilland, and when we finished shooting the scene, she came up and she said, "Was I all right?" And I said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Havilland, what do you mean?" And she said, "Was I all right? Was I good?" And I said, "Oh, my God, I don't know why you'd ask me, because, you know, you're a legend." And she said, "But you're an actor, same as I am. I just want to know what you think of my performance." So I was shocked by that. But it's so nice that she was so modest. You know, she was great. And some of the other people who I found with it, the nicer, the bigger the star is, the nicer they tend to be. You know, I found Paul Newman to be a very modest, lovely, welcoming man, and same with James Mason and Jack Palance. And yet the sort of second-rate TV movie star tends to be not quite so nice, because they haven't quite made it, and they are a bit out themselves.
Well, that makes sense, that they would tend to have more ego, because I think it seems to me that to be the cream of the crop, you have to be a graceful person who, I mean, it's another spiritual law. It seems to me that those who have much obtain much more. I'm not sure how it's stated in the Bible, but there's a saying to that effect. And, you know, egos come into play with people that don't have as much, that are hungry, that want more, and they never make it. They never make it, never make it to the point that they'd want to go. Let me just put it out there to anybody that's listening. We did have a caller on the line and we lost them. But if there's anybody that would like to talk to Shane Bryant, now's your golden opportunity. Just push one, and you can talk with a legend in his own time, Shane Bryant. Shane, you know what? Just to digress a little bit and go back to that notion of goodness and peace, if you will, you talked about how you believed in the spirituality of goodness, kindness, and love. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate a little bit on that and what you could say that could be of inspiration to other people that are hungering for that in their lives. What do you think you have done in your life that is attracting that into your life?
Well, I think if I always reach out and try and be kind to other people. I'll just give you an example of that. Sometimes when I walk to the supermarket, and just the other days, a guy who was a panhandler, just you know, absolutely down and out. He came up to me and he said, "Oh my God, it's you, isn't it? You're that guy. That's on television." And he reached out this hand, which was you know, covered with all kinds of, you know, stuff, like sort of a half a meat pie and chewing gum and whatever. So we sat in the gutter for about 10 minutes, and we chatted about this, that, and the other, and it made him happy, you know. So, and I just thought, well, that makes me happy, you know, and just interacting with people and not feeling that you're above them or better than them. And when people on Facebook, they want to have a chat and they want you to read their book, you know, it's going to take me maybe 2 hours to read a book. They send me their book on Facebook and they say, "Please, I want to know if it's any good. Can you read that and get back to me?" You're given the opportunity of saying, "Look, I'm far too busy to do that," or else read it and get back to them and give them your opinion. But if you haven't got time for people, then why would people have time for you? You know, I just think that if you treat everyone with respect and dignity, you know, then no matter who they might be or where they come from or whether they're a drug addict or the only people I don't have time for are people that are cruel to animals or or cruel to human beings.
Right. Well, I believe that that everything happens for a reason, and that people are drawn into our paths for various reasons, that there are no accidents, no mistakes. You talked earlier about something, wondering if there had been some mistake, and I'm sorry, I don't recall what it was, but I love the story of the street person that you encountered. I used to work with street people professionally, and I continue to interact with people that walk that walk, and I don't judge them for it. In fact, you know, I used to give out dollars to people standing on street corners, and I don't want to enable alcoholics, so I decided along with a friend that I'd make up a little lunch for them, non-perishable lunch with a flip-top can of soup that could be eaten cold or hot, and a little container of juice and a spoon. And then my cleaning lady, who is not does not have a brilliant life by any means, recommended something to me that I'd never thought of. She said, put a napkin in there. Let's treat these people with dignity. And I thought, whoa.
Oh, absolutely.
That's because I quite frequently don't use a napkin myself. The thought never occurred to me. But yes, we're all worthy.
Absolutely, yeah.
We're all worthy of dignity. And you showed that, man, human kindness. I mean, we are human beings after all. You know, I mean, we're not just human doings. Unless we interact and connect with each other, you know, as the saying goes, no man is an island, no woman is for that matter, and we've lost our humanity if we can't interact with everybody, you know?
Yeah. There was I was in a shopping mall, and we walked outside, and there was a guy in a wheelchair who had tubes coming out of his nose and his mouth, and he had something in a vein, and behind him his carer was standing behind him, and I just, you know, for a start I thought that he might be looking for some money, and then I realized of course he wasn't, and if I'd given him money he would have been so upset because he didn't want to be taken for a beggar but I just wanted to know if he was okay. So I went up, and then I was about to say to the carer, is there anything I can do to help you, you know, get wherever you're going? And then I realized that that if I did that, it would be like the other guy didn't exist. The guy in the wheelchair didn't exist. So I said it to him, and he mumbled something. And I think he was very grateful that I spoke to him rather than the carer. I didn't know what he said, but he just nodded and thanked me, and that was that. He was fine, apparently. But
that's
the sort of thing, you know.
Yes, that's an example of connection and an act of kindness. You know, I mean, we all want to be treated that way, so why not treat each other that way? You know, it's a two-way street out there, folks. Well, we're running toward the end of the hour, and I would like to ask you a couple of questions connected to people that want to be writers, that want to be actors. Based on your own experience, what kind of recommendations would you, or suggestions would you have to folks that have a dream for themselves and have no idea how to attain that dream?
Well, I think if you want to be an actor, a writer, start writing, and I think that's the first thing to do. Have an idea in your head about what you want to write about. It could be about spirituality. It could be about any idea that you have in your head, or it could be fiction. But and then allocate a certain amount of time each day for that project and make sure that you keep to that so that at the end of each day you've achieved a certain amount of work, be it one page or two pages. Doesn't matter, just one page is sufficient, because at the end of 250 days, you know, 9 months later, you're going to have the makings of a book.
Mm-hmm.
And you will feel really proud of having written it. Whether or not it's published or not is another point, you know. I remember years and years ago hearing that someone, he said, I've written a book, and I was so impressed by it, you know. He didn't say he'd had it published. I don't think he'd had it published, but he'd written a book, and he should
have
done that. Now, if you want to take it further and you want to be published, if your dream is to have your book published by a big publisher like Pan Macmillan or whoever it might be, Penguin, then you have to have a literary agent, and so you have to submit your manuscript to a literary agent and see what they think of it. The chances of that taking you on are very slim, but it's worth a shot. And keep trying every literary agent that you can until somebody says, look, I think you've got the makings of a book there. If all else fails and you can't get a literary agent, then you should self-publish. And by doing that, go to a site. May I suggest Create Space, and it's very easy to upload a book onto Create Space, and what happens is you're given an ISBN number, and your book is then available for anyone to buy on Amazon, and you can have it published on Kindle, so you've then written a book, and people can read it, and you can then put the link on Facebook and say, I've written a book, this is the link, do me a favor and buy it, and then put the word out. So that's if you want to be an author. If you want to be an actor, it's just remember that 98% of people don't succeed as an actor, but it's worth giving it a shot. But you've got to really believe that you're good. And again, having an agent is pretty much a must-have. So try and find yourself an agent. And you've really got to be pretty young. It's no use trying to start a career as an actor if you're over 30, especially if you're a girl, because, I don't know, it's just one of those unfair things that if you're a girl over 30, people think that you've missed the boat. So try and start your career young. Try and find an agent and try and put a show reel together. It's easy to do. You just do record on your computer and edit a little show reel together, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and show. That's just to show agents how good you can be. And once you've done that, again, show it to agents and see what they think. That would be my advice on both of those topics.
Well, thank you, Shane, and thank you for being with us tonight. And I will be speaking with you shortly. I've really enjoyed the hour. It's gone very quickly, and I wish you and yours the best.
Thank you. It's been absolutely delightful talking to you, and thanks for having me on your show.
My pleasure. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.